a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm going to call this meeting to order. I'd like to greet everybody that's on the internet and welcome them to this the meeting today of the Joint Commission on Government Operations and Audit. I'll remind you to turn your cell phones off, because we do have, it's up to the chairman to decide what the penalty is, and we have some really nice charitable organizations that if the cell phone goes off, you will be contributing to. I'll have the secretary call the roll, see if we have a quorum.
Senator Hunhoff?
Here.
Senator Hunstad?
Hi.
Senator Tiedemann?
Here.
Senator Peters?
Here.
Senator Haverly?
Here.
Representative Dennert?
Here.
Representative Dryden?
Here.
Representative Turbeville?
Here.
Representative Junkie?
Here.
Representative Carson?
Here.
All members are present.
Thank you. I would move to approve the minutes of the last meeting. We have a motion. Do we have a second?
Second.
All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. This afternoon we're going to hear from overview from youth care providers. If you come to the table and speak, make sure that you sign in so the secretary has your name and spelling of it. You can do that at the end. We'll get started. The hour is late, and we'd like to get moving as quick as we can on this. Thank you.
All right, sorry. Betty Oldenkamp, I'm the chair of the South Dakota Association for Youth Care Providers and the lobbyist for them. My other job is that I'm the president and CEO for Lutheran Social Services, which is one of the member organizations of this group. And I've got a couple of handouts, and I've brought my own pages along to distribute them. So we do know that the hour is late and that you've had a long week already, so we will be brief in what we cover. I want to start out by just saying thank you to those of you that did the tours this summer. I know that we've got a couple of new members on the committee that weren't part of that, but that was really important. Our service system, our providers, are not as well known as some of the other human and social service agencies. So we were very, very pleased with your interest to come and tour our facilities. It was especially meaningful for the kids in our programs. We don't get a lot of outside guests, and to have folks come in that are, in their estimation and in mine, very important people was very rewarding for all of those. You got two handouts there. I'm going to speak just to one point on the one that's got the purple logo on top. I think many of you have seen that before. If you drop down to the bottom, you'll see that 71.5% of our days of care are for kids that are in the custody of the state of South Dakota. We've really evolved as a system to meet the needs of the state, and that is really our bread and butter, and how we continue is to meet that need. And if that need someday goes away, then we most likely go away along with it. That piece is just more for your reference. I do want to acknowledge that we have had a strong partnership with the Department of Social Services and the Department of Corrections. They work, you know, cooperatively together, as well as with us as individual agencies and with our association as a whole. But that doesn't mean that they let us off the hook. They are also the monitoring and licensing body that oversees the work that we do. It's their responsibility, really, to make sure that the kids that are in our care are safe, that we meet the licensing requirements, and that we hopefully get positive outcomes. It's a pretty tough job. Sometimes means that we're not in full agreement, but I think what keeps us together is that common commitment to do what's in the best interests of the kids and families in South Dakota. So I've only been working with this group from the provider side of it for about 5 years. I think some of you know that I did work within the state of South government, state government, for 15 years in the Department of Human Services. So familiar territory, but it's been a little different to be out on the provider side. In that time, we've undergone many changes. The Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services informed the state, I believe it was in summer 2006 or summer in 2007, I'm not sure which one, that we needed to meet a new set of requirements called Psychiatric Residential Treatment Facility Level of Care in order to continue to receive Medicaid participation for the services that we provide. That meant a lot of changes in our system, changes in practices, how we deal with seclusion and restraint. It meant changes in the number of staff that we have to have in our facilities. It meant changes in the qualifications of those staff. The staffing ratios and those requirements are a federal requirement for the psychiatric level of care. We have other staffing requirements for the lower level of care, the group care piece. But when you look at those, and that's one of the points that on the one page that you have, the staffing costs, direct care staffing costs and benefits are about 69% of our expenses. If you start to add in some other things that we have as fixed costs, mortgages, utilities, those kinds of things, you get up in the 80% range. I'm not going to focus on that more than that because we know this isn't a budget hearing or an appropriations hearing. One of the other changes that we have also gone through is there's been an additional level of care added, an intensive residential treatment level of care. There are two programs in the state that have that level of care. As that was happening, the change in the requirements, the addition of the intensive residential treatment, we've also at the same time had a decrease in the demand for the residential treatment beds overall. Some of that was because there's been a decrease in the number of our surrounding states that have placed kids in South Dakota programs. But I think a bigger piece and more important piece of that is that some of those efforts at community-based and family-based services have paid off. And that's a good thing for families and for kids. It makes it tough for us when we've got, the infrastructure in place for residential programs. But as I said early on, we're about what's in the best interest of kids and families. And so we have been working with the agencies. You have all known, I think, that there were a couple of programs that closed recently. Lutheran Social Services closed one of our units in January of 2009. In the course of the time since we've been kind of looking at the changes in the bed system from August of 2006, we had 796 beds that were licensed. And with the two recent closures, we are down to 579 beds. So we've had a decrease of 217 beds, or 27% of the licensed bed capacity in the state. So trying to match up the licensed beds with where the need is. I think, as we look at our system, we think we're doing a pretty good job, but we know we have room for growth, and we know we have some challenges. One of the things we've experienced with the move to the psychiatric treatment facility level of care is the kids within our programs. It used to be if you had a couple of really tough kids, then maybe you would balance that off with a couple of easier kids. And because of the process, the screening that goes into place, the concentration of those tough kids in our programs is higher. And that makes it challenging in terms of having the appropriate staff and challenging in terms of keeping kids safe and keeping staff safe. We also know that there's growing emphasis on looking at permanency for kids, that's one of the things that has really been, from a research standpoint, been proven to be in the best interest of kids and families to have permanent situations and to, if at all possible, have those be a family member that they're with. And so we really look at how do we, in terms of when a kid comes into our program, how do we try to help limit the number of programs they're in, And then also, how do we get them out of our program and back home into a stable setting as quickly as possible? We are looking at discharge outcomes and trying to measure our effectiveness. Sometimes it's hard because when a kid leaves our care, we don't necessarily know where they're at a year down the road, 18 months down the road. We can do generally a shorter-term follow-up, but the longer term is harder for us. We have increasing difficulties with staff recruitment and retention. We're currently in fiscal year 10, as a system, had a 38% turnover rate. I know for Lutheran Social Services, we just looked at that for calendar year 2010, and it was at 50%. It gets really hard to sustain quality of care when you've got that high of a turnover. We've been fortunate to keep our core staff, our clinical staff, our supervisory staff, but it's those direct care positions that are just kind of a revolving door for us. I already mentioned that we're continuing to look at trying to keep our bed capacity aligned with the demand. And I think all of us, face those challenges of how to make our budgets work out and our budgets balance as well. The second handout that you have is in regard to a project that we've been involved with for a couple of years, a benchmarking project. And I would like to invite Eric Clues from Abbott House forward. He's been much more involved in managing this project to explain what that has been and what that data is.
Thank you, Representative Carson and committee. At the end of the day, I get to talk to you about outcomes, so I'm sure I probably won't keep you too excited. But outcomes are something that have been really important to me. And in 2007, started working with our association to develop a benchmarking process. And we did a national search, and we selected Behavioral Pathway Systems, which is a national group. They're experts in outcomes and creating benchmarks. And our whole goal with doing this was really to move the behavioral health care system forward. In the past, the way outcomes have worked is we all collect them, and then every quarter, and at Abbott House we have hundreds of them we look at. One of them would just be staff turnover, like Betty talked about. And every quarter we look at our outcomes, and then we usually compare them to the next quarter. And in doing that, what we really do is we look at our own outcomes, and then we evaluate them against ourselves. And that doesn't always give you the best outlook on what is good and what is bad. And the best way, I think, to explain the benchmarking process and what we've tried to do the last 4 years is if we all went to the doctor and our temperature was 100.3 and everybody else at the doctor's office temperature was 101 or 102 or worse, and the doctor got to us and said, you know what, you have the best temperature of people that are here today, so you're fine, why don't you go home? And then in a month and a half, we died of a staph infection. That's not how hospitals work. Obviously, they know that 98.6 is normal. And in the behavioral health care field, there's a lot of ifs and ands out there about what program works the best, what's best for kids and families. And so our benchmarking process has really done that. It is through this company they have created hundreds of metrics that are outcomes that are set up exactly the same across all providers. The organization has teamed up with our association as well as 90 other organizations across the country and 26 other states. There's thousands of children that they work with, and we're all dumping our data into this database every quarter, and then we monitor it. And the goal is to look for those organizations that do a really good job in certain areas and then learn from them, and that information is shared. And I wanted to just share with you, and you've got the handout in front of you. It's the one that looks like this, and it's blue and white, and it's got a little chart in the middle of it. I want to share with you those outcomes really quickly. The median length of stay for South Dakota organizations is 201 days per child that goes into the residential treatment centers. That's 4% below the median average for all these organizations across the country. So we're right in line with what most other organizations are doing as far as how long treatment lasts. The cost per day in South Dakota on average is $198.67. Across the other organizations, it's $260.27 or $61.60 different. So we're 24% cheaper than other organizations providing the same level of care across the country. The manual restraint, and that's when a staff or multiple staff have to physically intervene with a child that's hurting themselves or hurting someone else. And we do those in our facilities, but we do that 34% less than facilities like us across the country. The next one there is injuries from restraints then. And we're very happy to report that for children in our facilities, they're injured 55% less than in other facilities like us around the country. Staff injuries are amazing if you look down at the next one, 96%. We're 96% more effective at keeping staff safe in our facilities than others around the country. 72% less aggression in males as with regard to harming others in our facilities. The last two there are aggression towards male and damage to property, females damage to property, and it's 41% and 67%. So what I would hope you would take from this or that you'd see in here is one, that our facilities have been dedicated to quality treatment for 4 years now. We've been doing this. All of us have to invest funds to do it. Every facility has to make the decision on how they're going to pay to get into this project, and all of us have been cutting staff and benefits and those things the last 2 years without rate increases, but we haven't lost one facility that didn't want to get into this project. And I guess what I'd leave you with is that if you look down through these numbers, our facilities are in line with how long other children are in care. We're much more cost effective. We're 24% less of a cost than most other facilities. And if you look through all the other statistics, we're much, much safer at what we do.
Thanks, Rick. We do collect more metrics than that. Those were the ones we highlighted because we knew of your interest in regard to the injury and restraint and the aggressive behaviors. And, of course, we can let you off without the cost one because it looks so good. So that's really what we had in terms of presentation. And I know that you all have either travel plans or probably are at long day and ready to get out of here. But we will obviously be here to answer any questions you might have. I would just ask that for those of you that did do the tours this summer, that as you contemplate those very difficult decisions that you have before you in the next 18, 17 days, whatever it is, remember the kids that you saw, the kids that you met. They have incredible life experiences. Many of them have gone on or continuing on in our programs and finding success. One of the young men that helped with one of our tours, Dakota, has completed our program. He is back home in Sturgis and back in public school. Another young gal, Jasmine, did really well. She worked hard in her program. She was attending public school, working part-time, getting ready to transition into an independent living program and hopefully this spring move into an apartment. She's struggling right now because she's got all kinds of new freedom, and it's hard for her to make good decisions when she doesn't have a full support network around her. And so we're really confident that she will, work through these struggles and be able to stay out in the setting, in the community, and in the public school. I think it's real important. Our kids are oftentimes forgotten. And so we really hope that as you move forward, you keep them in the forefront of your minds. They go through a lot, but they're very resilient. They're bright, and they can become very productive adults for us. So that's it for our presentation. We take any questions. I should note, too, that there are several of our member agencies that made the trip in today. Obviously, very important for them. I think we've got probably half of our agencies represented here.
Thank you. Is there anybody else that would like to come before the committee with any comments? Representative Peters.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator okay. Peters.
I answer to both. I did have a question. I guess I was hoping to hear a little bit more about the impact of the closures on your facilities that are going on in Springfield and up in Lemon, I believe. Can you explain a little bit about the closures? Are you prepared to talk about any of that?
I can't discuss in detail, obviously not part of those. I do know the program in Springfield, all those kids have been placed into other programs, and I believe the physical facility itself is on the market. For Sky Ranch, they have, I believe the end of March is when the last of their kids will leave. They primarily served kids from Iowa, only a couple of South Dakota kids, and then they will be disposing of their facility. They are making a lot of their furnishings and stuff available to the rest of us. So that's about the extent that I can go into. What it, in terms of the rest of us, what it does, the Springfield facility was a psychiatric residential treatment facility. So some of those, you know, kids, when they left there, moved into some of our other programs. So our occupancy got stronger, got better. On the group care side, which is what Sky Ranch is, that's the lower level of care. Since they only had a couple of South Dakota kids there, it didn't really have an impact on the rest of us. So,
do you, thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you know some of the reasons why that they closed? Can you kind of go into some of the reason, rationalizations why they closed? Was it all financial? Was it programming, licensing? I mean, what were some of the reasons or rationales for the decisions? Do you?
I really can't speak to Springfield Academy, but I can tell you about my personal experience with closing a program 2 years ago, the Woodfield Center in Beresford. Combination of factors. It was an old facility that was not well suited for the challenges of the youth that we were seeing in terms of the psychiatric level of care, because it didn't have good lines of sight for supervision, those kinds of things. Small community where we had tremendous difficulties recruiting and retaining the quality level of staff that we needed in there. We could fulfill the direct care needs. We couldn't keep nurses. We couldn't keep clinical people. You know, they just didn't want to move in there for what we could pay them. And so those were some of the issues that we faced. I'm assuming that those were some of the same issues that were faced at Springfield Academy. But I really can't speak to the specifics of that situation.
Senator Hundhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Odenkamp, just a question. With the youth that we have at HSC for the behavioral health, are those, any of those children, would they be potential candidates for your residential treatment if we looked at doing something different?
Thank you, Senator Hanoff. And I'm assuming it's still the same, that they have three different levels of care within the adolescent units at the Human Services Center. And it is not uncommon for youth to come to one of our programs from the inpatient setting. In terms of if we were to do something differently in the community setting, could we serve more of those kids? Most likely. I mean, typically when you look at institutional programs and trying to look at community alternatives, if it may mean that more intensive level of care, I would assume that the biggest barrier would be the availability of appropriate level of psychiatric time. You know, that to me, when I look at the differences between what we do in the community setting and what can happen in the Human Services Center, is they have the availability of medical intervention 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We don't. And so if you've got a youth that is very unstable in terms of their mental health treatment and maybe needs a, you know, more closely monitoring or adjusting of their medications, we, you know, oftentimes don't have that availability. We're more fortunate in Sioux Falls with the programs that are located there, but outside of that, across the state, that would be the challenge.
Could I just ask two more questions? And it's probably for the gentleman that's with you. In looking at your metrics and, again, cost, just a question. Do you know, are the mix of staff the similar to these states when we talk about cost?
I would say that there's probably some variance, but it's probably fairly similar because we're all the psychiatric residential treatment, IRT, which is all that federally mandated. We have federally mandated requirements of what you have to have. Now, every state can have some different requirements in their state plan, which could add or detract for some of the costs, but that's probably the best I could answer that.
Just one more. Have you ever done paid hours per resident day?
No, we have not.
Any other questions? Go ahead, Representative.
Hey, but, if I may, I'd like to have a couple questions for the gentleman from Wellspring.
Go ahead.
May I? Come on. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, in light of the... I was just listening to Ms. Olenkamp talk about the reasons for closing some facilities. And there are several. And I, along with Senator Haveley, have toured your facility. You guys do a wonderful job.
Thank you.
However, the facility, in my estimation, is on the verge of being too small, outdated, insufficient in a lot of different areas. Has the department, the state, whoever, set up any plan with you, or do you have something that you could tell us to update the facility itself, the building, possibly look at a new location? What are your plans in that area?
I don't know that is the responsibility of the state or facilities. I can say that Wellspring had begun looking at plans for a new facility on that site. We are in the process of beginning a feasibility study to see if it's feasible to raise the kind of money that would be necessary to replace the facility that's there. And as Betty spoke earlier, I believe that some of those costs, once we have a facility, if we have to get a mortgage or those kinds of things, would be at some point figured into our rates.
Add to that.
One moment. Sir, would you identify yourself so the secretary has your name and where you're representing, please?
I'm sorry. I would be happy to do that. I'm Jay Van Hunnick, and that's V-A-N and a space H-U-N-N-I-K, and I'm the executive director at Wellspring in Rapid City.
Go ahead.
Just in terms of construction costs or facility costs, Medicaid does not allow for capital outlay like that. They will, however, in terms of reimbursement, recognize depreciation, mortgage, those kinds of things, but Medicaid doesn't allow for that cash up front, so to speak. So generally, when it comes to new buildings, we raise the money or borrow the money, and then over the depreciation of the building, that's recognized in the rate. So...
Thank you. I appreciate that, and I wish you good luck in that endeavor. Because, to be honest with you, I mean, you guys are doing a wonderful job with what you have, but you do need a new facility, and I would urge the state to take a long, hard look at that, and I hope that you do a quick feasibility study, because I know what you're going to find out, and I'd like to see the results of that when you're finished.
Would be happy to share that, Representative.
Thank you.
Representative Dennard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Olenkamp, with that question from the representative to my right, I know Aberdeen's facility is relatively new and in pretty good shape. I know Abbott House has did some expanding, remodeling, or rebuilding. Is there any other of these facilities that are in the condition that Representative Turbeville is talking about?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to look to my group. I think there might be a couple that are not as good a shape. As you referenced the facility in Aberdeen, that was, I believe, 2005, so that it was updated. I know Volunteers of America's one facility's not in great shape. I don't know for sure about Sacred Hearts. So it's an ongoing issue. any type of capital improvements are, you know, challenges.
Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So can you, what's the status of the Springfield? Is it renovatable or utilizable if somebody else wanted to go in there and open one? I mean, is it deteriorated that condition?
I have not been inside that facility probably for 2 years, so I can't really speak to that. I know they had done some facility changes and improvements. I believe it's like an old Catholic boarding school or something of that nature. And just off from that alone, that old dorm structure doesn't make a transition very well to the types of treatment settings we have now. So I think there would be real challenges in that, just the physical design and layout of that being a place that would work really well for the type of treatment services that we're looking at now. But again, I haven't been in a while to know what kind of current condition the building itself is in.
Any other questions? I've got one quick question. You referenced that you had about a 38% turnover in the last year. You've had approximately a 50% turnover. Where these facilities are at, the turnover, what kind of a workforce is out there available to you with those kind of turnovers?
I think that varies from community to community. Depending upon if you're in a community with a college that offers, you know, degrees in related fields, then your direct care pool or your overtime pool, you're able to get some kids that are in college wanting to pick up some related work experience. That's our situation in Spearfish. We have a high turnover there in part because of that, because they're there for a couple of years and then they move on they graduate and move on to other places. I think some of the communities that don't have that struggle a little bit more. I believe that was part of the issue at Springfield. We do have someone here from Aurora Plains in Plankington, and I'm thinking that's part of their issue at time to time is availability of workforce. Occasionally we struggle in Aberdeen because the unemployment there is still, you know, I think a little lower than other places in the state. So,
thank you. Go ahead, Representative Trevorville.
I got farther to drive than any of you, so I'm okay. I'm looking at the average starting pay for a degreed staff is $11 an hour. What kind of benefit, you know, program do you have? Are you on the state plan or what?
Thank you, Representative Turberville. No, we are not on the state plan, and that is an average of the starting salaries for people with four-year degrees across all of our programs at the $11 an hour. Each agency looks at what they can offer for benefits. We do generally provide some participation in an employee health insurance, but the degree that we do that varies greatly across our agencies. Retirement benefits is another piece that is offered by most agencies, not all. Many of us, LSS included, over the course of the last few years have had to make adjustments. We pay less than we used to towards our employees' health insurance. We've cut retirement contributions. And as far as some of the other optional types of benefit, vision, dental, kind of depend upon what you may have for a health insurance plan overall. It's one of the areas where we're really struggling, and I, you know, I've heard all the reasons not to include provider systems in the state insurance plan. We've talked about can we somehow pool together as a group, because the rates are really just getting impossible for us to provide any kind of reasonable plan for our employees at a rate that we can afford.
Okay. I don't have anything else. No, the only thing I'd say is, you know, four-year degree and you're making $23,000 a year gross in a very inadequate benefit program, you're to be commended that your turnover rate is only 38%. I think you are woefully underfunded, which is, and now you're looking at additional cuts. So I commend you people for what you do.
Thank you.
Senator Peters, I'm sorry.
That's all right. Going back to the health insurance, now kind of walk through the reasons why you guys can't come together. I mean, is there regulations that forbid this, or is there something, rule or regulation or something that we need to change in order to make this happen for you? Or is it just your organizations not wanting to play nice in the sandbox?
Well, I'd love to tell you that there's a rule that prevents us from doing it, but I think up to this point in time, we've kind of all had our own plans and done our own thing. I can't remember how many years ago that there was a change in legislation that does allow for, I believe, some more cooperative groups. And so we have started to have some discussion around that. It's going to mean that some of us have to, you know, if we're going to jump into this, give up some things. But I think that it's that to that point for many of us. There are some that probably would choose not to come into it because, you know, we have a couple that are self-insured and that's working for them. But there are a number of us that are going, we just can't sustain this anymore and we need to find a better way to approach this topic. So I guess we have to learn to play nicer in the sandbox.
Thank you. Are there any other comments that need to come before the committee today? Well, thank you very much for being here. Thank you very much for your interest. Your very interesting presentation, and we will probably see you again before the session's over.
I think we would like to come see you next week. So, thank you.
Is there any other things that need to come before the committee today? I'm sorry. I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Thank you.